Well, greetings, Sun Sounds of Arizona listeners. I'm Roy Weinberg, and this is the Monday, October 13th, 2025 edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This week, I'll start with the From the Editor column, and then I'll read the cover story. After that, I'll read Global Newsstand and then the Explainer, the Home Forum, and then finally the Monitor's View. So getting right into it, the From the Editor column is entitled Seeing Both Sides with Honesty and Clarity. This is written by Mark Sappenfield, who is a senior global correspondent, and you can email him at sappenfieldm@csmonitor.com. And he writes, from the United States to Sweden, immigration has become the Western world's biggest political fault line, dividing societies and fueling anger and mistrust. That fault line runs directly through Tam Hussein. Mr. Hussein is Swedish, born and raised in a suburb of Stockholm, and like many Swedes, he has looked on the changes in his homeland during the past 10 years with shock. Organized crime and gun violence exploded after the country took in some 160,000 migrants in 2015, and he says he sometimes has trouble fathoming how much his country has changed. When I grew up, there were hardly any crime apart from bicycle stealing, and that was scandalous, he says. When you see what's going on today, it does upset you. That's not how Sweden should be. Mr. Hussein is a son of Bangladeshi parents and the child of a more global world. As a journalist, he has covered the Middle East and other aspects of the new Sweden are not only familiar but also welcome. After living in Damascus, Syria, he found recent changes to the Swedish city in Malmo invigorating. Authentic shawarma, street corner conversations in Arabic, startup newspapers in Bengali. I loved it, he says. So often, politics sets up false choices. It turns complex issues into a simplified this or that with no space for anything in between. At best, this makes voters' choices starker. At worst, it dehumanizes opponents and preys on fear. But Mr. Hussein cannot choose this or that on the issue of migration in Sweden. He has to choose both because he is both. In reporting my cover story this week on how migration has shaped Sweden and Denmark, I saw clearly why such a mindset is important. Two things stuck out about his approach. First was a deep and genuine sense of compassion. To varying degrees, those on either side of the migration issue expressed some exasperation at or contempt for those on the other side, but Mr. Hussein wouldn't go there. On one hand, he understands why migrants would feel so out of step with their new Swedish home. In Sweden, you're dependent on the state to do everything, he says. But imagine now you're getting people coming in and they don't have any trust in the government. They're going to look after their own. But he also has sympathy for native Swedes worried about the direction of the country. I can understand that sentiment because Sweden has changed. The second point is that Mr. Hussein understands the situation in a way that helped me really grasp what was going on. Although I didn't quote Mr. Hussein in the story, subsequent reporting validated what he shared. Put simply, by seeing both sides honestly, he sees the situation most accurately. Today, strong currents of thought encourage us not to do this. The umbrage engines of social media and politics work by simplifying and separating. But Mr. Hussein refused to be drawn in, and that compassion gave him not only decency and grace, but also clarity. And that was the From the Editor column written by Mark Sappenfield, a senior global correspondent. And this week it was entitled, Seeing Both Sides with Honesty and Clarity. And now for the cover story. It's entitled, Inside Europe's Most Dramatic Migration Experiment. As immigrants from Muslim countries find their way north, Denmark and Sweden wrestle with how or whether to be a haven for those who are war-weary and vulnerable. This is written by Mark Sappenfield, who's a staff writer, and they do have that paragraph here, why we wrote this. Denmark and Sweden have taken different approaches to accepting immigrants. Their experiences may provide lessons for other Western societies. From Copenhagen, Denmark, and Malmö, Sweden, across the graceful arc of bridge that spans the Øresund Strait and its wind-feathered waves, Copenhagen is only 5 miles from Sweden and the port city of Malmö. Many days, the spike of Malmö's tallest building is visible from the Danish capital, the twisting architectural marvel rising like an object of fantasy above the swaddling layers of marine mist. But since 2015, the two cities have lived in very different worlds. Migrants from Syria, Afghanistan, and North African countries have come by the tens of thousands, streaming north to Europe in search of safety and a new place to call home. But Denmark and Sweden responded to the situation in diametrically different ways. As a result, the two countries have now created the Western world's most dramatic dueling experiments, not only on migration policy, but also on an understanding of multiculturalism and democracy. With some of the strongest immigration laws in Europe, Denmark showed an unambiguous determination to keep migrants out. It cut benefits to asylum seekers and passed a law that allowed authorities to seize valuables worth more than 1,340 euros, or about $1,565, from refugees to pay their food and housing costs. A court even fined a woman and her husband 6,000 euros for human smuggling when they drove a refugee family across the country. Sweden, meanwhile, essentially flung its doors wide, accepting more than 160,000 migrants into the country of 11 million people. Looking at their Nordic neighbor, Swedes were appalled, calling Denmark racist and morally destitute. Now, Sweden's political parties see Denmark as a model. Since 2015, organized crime in Sweden has risen dramatically, and nightly news programs are filled with reports of bombings and grenade attacks. As recently as 2023, Sweden had the second highest rate of gun violence in Europe, and Malmö was seen as the epicenter. One Swedish commentator called it the Swedish Raqqa, comparing it to the former de facto capital of the Islamic State group. In recent years, the far-right Sweden Democrats have blamed all these ills on the country's former immigration policies. The party has also risen to historic heights, becoming an influential partner in the current government. Swedes' policies, in fact, have begun to mimic Denmark's. The story, however, is not as simple as it might seem. The portraits of Copenhagen and Malmö since 2015 are complex. Together, they offer the world a unique picture of how opposite approaches to immigration can play out, with challenges and benefits on both sides. And they reveal a fundamental question: how do societies balance priorities of compassion and order? Many in Denmark and Sweden say neither country has yet found the right balance. But somewhere between the two is a bridge of a different kind, not made of steel and suspension cable, but of the ability to balance care for one's own people while also taking reasonable responsibility for those from abroad seeking a better life. "Who decides who can get into a society?" asked Christian Albrecht Larsen, an expert on the Danish welfare state at Aalborg University. Can those who live there decide, or do those knocking on the door have a right? For much of the Western world, that comes down to the debate over what should be done for Farzad Rahimi. Denmark's migration policies are largely built around trying to keep migrants like Mr. Rahimi out. He left India alone at age 11 and after 5 years in Iran, arrived in Europe as a 16-year-old unaccompanied minor. Along the way, he was subjected to the trauma of watching friends being tortured by smugglers and a fellow migrant getting shot and killed at the Turkish border. As the son of Afghan refugees, he is also Muslim, a faith that has often clashed with the continent's strict secularism. In short, he fit the profile of migrants who, according to statistics, on average, require more money and effort to integrate. But Sweden didn't care. Before 2015, there was a very positive government view on migration and protecting refugees, says Bernd Paruso, an analyst at the Swedish Institute for European Policy Studies. It was not controversial in Swedish society. Partly, this was the Swedish view of Swedishness. In Sweden, they have the idea of being so progressive that they don't have a culture at all, says Marlena Gugges, author of the book Collective Identity and Integration Policy in Denmark and Sweden. The culture is human rights science-based, values everyone can obtain, she says. The Swedish view is that everyone can become Swedish. So why couldn't Mr. Rahimi? The country welcomed him with a home and at last a measure of peace. And for a time, it could hardly have gone better. I learned the language and got a job, and I felt I was a Swedish person, he says. To him, his arrival seemed a moment of divine grace. Maybe God decided, this is your country, by stopping me that day. Then came the first encounter with drugs and the descent into violence and organized crime. I didn't have a parent to tell me I was on the wrong path. I was free, too free, says Mr. Rahimi, whose name has been changed for his safety. Before long, he was running drugs and weapons, ending up in prison four times for drug use, drug dealing, and violent conduct. He had become a part of Sweden's new story. Across the bridge in Denmark, fingers began pointing. As crime in Sweden grew, Danes felt their immigration policies were vindicated. Malmö became a cautionary tale. As crime spread across Sweden, however, it began chipping away at the country's sense of openness. Malmö was becoming a cautionary tale within the country, too. There was more crime before 2015, but it was still perfectly manageable, says Stefan Hedlund, a commentator and professor of East European Studies at Uppsala University in Sweden. In 2015, you poured gasoline on the fires. We imported a problem that we simply do not know how to handle. In 2017, President Donald Trump made headlines when he told a Florida rally, "Who would believe this? Sweden. They took in large numbers of immigrants. They're having problems like they'd never thought possible." All agree that there is truth to the concerns. Events in 2015 brought a bigger population of young men with risk factors, says Sven Granath, a criminologist at Stockholm University. Data tells us there is a high overrepresentation of immigrants in criminal violence, both as participants and as victims. But how widespread gang violence is and how connected it is to migration is open to debate and politically charged. Gang leaders are predominantly the Swedish-born children of migrants who came decades ago. That suggests to some that the larger issue then and now is integration. Some people don't feel like they truly belong and have equal opportunities, and so they are drawn to these gangs and an alternative career in crime, says Dr. Pruisell of the Swedish Institute for European Policy Studies. Could Malmö have done better? Perhaps, but the numbers were daunting. It was a huge amount of people in a short time, says Bodil Nyberg, a caseworker for a city anti-crime initiative called Krami. The system couldn't handle it. Integration can be hard. Sedat Arif knows that firsthand. On a glorious late summer afternoon, Mr. Arif is walking through his old neighborhood, Rosengard, in Malmö. Around Sweden, Rosengard became synonymous with the post-2015 crime wave. Gangs patrolled some streets after nightfall, marking their turf and questioning those who entered. One local social worker describes recent years in the area as war. Now, a deputy mayor of Malmö, Mr. Arif, can walk through his old neighborhood and see a different picture. Gun deaths are down significantly in recent years, and Rosengard is tidy and brimming with activity, hardly a picture of urban decay. A man sits in a cafe, pecking away at his laptop as others chatter at tables nearby. A travel agency in the main shopping mall promotes trips to every corner of the Middle East, and a clothing store purchases a kefaya scarf atop a Swedish blonde mannequin. Malmo's reputation was always disproportionate to the actual threat, Mr. Arise says, but progress has also come through hard work. By accepting more refugees than other Swedish cities, Malmo took a bigger responsibility, and that created challenges, he says. The unemployment rate here is high. Employers in the city are creating jobs, he says, but much of the migrant population doesn't have the education or the skills to take them. He shares that it took his father 12 years to find a job after the family migrated from Yugoslavia to Sweden in 1990. Being unemployed for 10 to 12 years is disastrous, he says. You lose faith in yourself. There are problems at home. Things are better these days, and a program called Job Tracks is helping. More than 80% of participants in the city's job training course find full-time work, Mr. Arif says. Over the past 4 years, he adds, those receiving social assistance in the city declined from 10,200 to 6,100. I would be crazy to say we don't have any problems because it's not true, he says. We do see the problems and we need to solve them. Denmark, by comparison, has had far fewer such problems to solve. Partly to inform the nation's migration policy, the finance ministry calculates how much different groups either contribute to or draw from the national budget. According to its 2019 report, people of Danish heritage contributed 15 billion euros, about $17.6 billion, to state coffers, while migrants and first-generation descendants from the Middle East and North Africa cost Denmark 3.2 billion euros. Despite this, both economists and refugee experts say Denmark could do more without unduly straining its system. The real question is one of priorities and values. It comes down to a political decision, says Torben Andersen, an economist at Aarhus University in Denmark. Do you want to spend 2% of the budget or 5% or 10%? Whether you're willing to spend that money depends on your political and humanitarian viewpoint. If you look at the political arguments today, that's exactly what's going on. Denmark's answer has been to be extremely selective about the migrants it takes. In 2024, it granted asylum to 864 people, a historic low for a non-pandemic year. In recent years, Denmark has also accepted 200 refugees annually from the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR. In parentheses, as of 2023, similar-sized Norway was accepting 2,000. A new policy allows work for migrants from only 16 countries whose nationals are believed to be easier to integrate based on likely economic contributions. And in parentheses, none of the countries are in the Middle East or Africa. This economic approach has transformed Danish politics. For Denmark's Social Democratic Party, 2015 had a significance beyond the migrant crisis. It was an election year, and the left-center party was, frankly, tired of losing. Since 2001, the course of Danish politics has been largely set by the far-right Danish People's Party, which proclaimed that Denmark's once liberal immigration policy had been a failure. Voters clearly thought it had a point. In 2015, the Danish People's Party finished with 21% of the vote, its best result by far. And for the fourth time in the past five elections, the Social Democrats were frozen out of power. But the new leader of the Social Democrats, Mette Frederiksen, had a plan. No longer would the Social Democrats be the party of urban elites. Liberal Copenhagen would be largely abandoned to build strength in working-class towns and rural areas. Now, the issue of immigration was key. Under Ms. Frederiksen, the Social Democrats would be as tough on immigration as any party on the right. It worked. In 2019, the Social Democrats won the election, and Ms. Frederiksen has been prime minister ever since. Meanwhile, the far-right Danish People's Party collapsed. In 2022, it won only five seats. For liberal political parties throughout the West, Prime Minister Frederiksen embodies a problem other leaders are facing. Has she betrayed progressive ideals, or is she a model for how to get back to working class roots? Charlotte Ahlgreen is conflicted. On one hand, the Copenhagen resident is no fan of the Social Democrats, and she loves seeing signs of new diversity on the streets. But she also says Denmark needs to be clear-eyed. The Danish welfare state works only if everyone pays in. People from certain countries come here with a different family setup, she says. The women don't work. Not that I don't want to help, but it needs to be both ways. I think it's really necessary that we have strong immigration laws. Denmark's welfare system is the country's crown jewel, says Rune Stabager, a political scientist at Aarhus University. In a recent magazine article, two government ministers declared, "It is the Nordic social democracies that have created the best societies in the world." And that idea has huge support among Danish voters, creating a kind of Danish welfare state-first policy, says Professor Stubager. Ms. Ahlgreen has felt the benefits. When her daughter recently had a severe injury, she paid nothing for the treatments. "If I had to pay for that, I couldn't do it. I don't have the money," says the single mother, a widow. Now her daughter is heading off to college, at no cost. "If we open our doors completely, our system won't work," she adds. "I see myself as humanistic, but we all pay to have this amazing system." Others go further. In Roskilde, a town of 51,000, a half-hour train ride west of Copenhagen, Holger Hansen waits with a friend outside the station. Smiles come easily to his whiskered chin as he laughs and talks about current events. Asked about Danish immigration policy today, he doesn't pause. "I'm satisfied with it," he says. "We like to take care of people who have serious problems, not people coming here changing our policy and religion and society." The subtext is clear. Denmark has long worried about migrants, particularly Muslims, setting up parallel societies that challenge the Danish identity. For example, when a Danish newspaper published cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad in 2005, many Danes were shocked at the backlash to what many considered basic free speech. Mojib Weyand has lived with this tension almost his entire life. Mr. Weyand and his family moved to Denmark from Afghanistan in 2000, and he acknowledges he was fortunate. His father, a doctor, was able to find work in Denmark. His mother got a Danish degree in pedagogy. Mr. Weyand attended Danish school since kindergarten. Yet is he Danish? Denmark's view of Danishness is, in many ways, the opposite of the Swedish view. Danish identity sits uneasily with multiculturalism. They are a very well-functioning society, and the system works as well as it does because of their sameness, says Ms. Gugges, the expert on collective identity and integration policy in both countries. They share values, and Danishness comes from history, and you can't just learn it. You need to understand it, and to do that, you need to be part of the society. You need to be Danish. There was a time when Mr. Weyand considered himself Danish. He says he has always been treated well. Even when he attended a private school and classmates openly talked about the problems with immigrants, he didn't feel personal animus. They didn't think of him as an immigrant. He was one of the good ones. In high school, he went even further, partying and socializing in ways that weren't consistent with his upbringing. "It's a big part of the culture, and it was way easier for me to fit in and be accepted," he says. "Culture and religion-wise, you had to compromise your values for the Danish culture." But on this day, he is sitting in the orange light of late afternoon with a dozen odd friends from DFUNK, the youth arm of the Danish Refugee Council, a private humanitarian organization. Some are wearing hijabs and some are native Danes, but all have come to be themselves without the weight of cultural expectations. "The older I get, the more I realize I have different underlying values than many of the Danes," he says. "I don't want to go out every weekend to go drinking. I don't want to go from one girl to another. Why did I sell myself to be accepted?" Today, Mr. Weyand considers himself Afghan Dane, but he knows it is harder for other Afghans and Muslims who aren't as culturally ambidextrous as him. Tarek Kalani, the head of DFUNK, says it's often the case that the more migrants learn Danish, the less they feel because of the strong political rhetoric against immigrants. The people who come here are very quick to recognize you are not welcome. You cannot ignore it. He says, only half joking, that it sometimes feels like Denmark's policy is, if we make it really unfriendly, they might want to go back. For Sweden, there is no going back. Last year, a third of Swedish births were to foreign-born mothers. But as national politics take large strides towards Denmark, Malmo is taking the opposite approach. It is leaning in to its multicultural identity. Deputy Mayor Arif notes that, during World War II, Sweden sent 75 buses to Germany to provide freed prisoners from concentration camps a place to stay. They returned with more than 15,000 refugees and brought them to Malmo. Through its history, Malmo has taken in refugees from Chile, from Yugoslavia, and from Iraq, to name a few. This city, today with a population of 365,000, brings together 187 nationalities and 140 languages. For us, it's about continuing the proud history of being a safe harbor for those leaving war and persecution, says Mr. Arif. As a result, Malmo is in many respects a glimpse of a new Sweden. It can be seen in the phalanx of hoodie-wearing gaming programmers, heads down, earphones on, everywhere through this city. Malmo has assembled one of the most robust gaming industries in the world. Half of the workforce is not Swedish. None of this would be possible without migrants, says Peter Lubeck of Game Habitat, a workspace for gaming companies. It can be seen on the bus, where one, a lifelong Stockholm resident, says people are much more open. I love it in Malmo, says Rita Verki, who moved here 4 years ago. I can connect with people. You sit on a bus and it's easy to speak with them, which she attributes to Malmo's mix of cultures. And it can be seen at the back of the Rosgard Public Library, where Maria Roiger furtively opens a door. As a library manager, she does not want to disturb the happy thrum of what's going on inside. Huddled together in the dim light of a few floor lamps, native Swedes and migrants of all description are chatting during one of the library's weekly language cafes. Mrs. Roiger acknowledges that her library does comparatively little in the way of book lending. Her staff members often joke that they feel like more like employees at a copy and print store than librarians. But that is what our residents need help with, she says. After several tough years for the city, she sees positive changes gaining momentum. When the language cafes were teeming with participants years ago, many of the students themselves became volunteers to help. It was a very beautiful thing, Mrs. Roiger says. Past cafe participants have come back to tell her they have become doctors or bus drivers. When she has her regular meetings with police, she has less and less to talk about. This is a fantastic place where you can test things, she adds. You can do really good work. You can help people. For Mr. Rahimi, Malmo is a place for a second chance. In his four trips to prison, he always promised himself that this time he'd get his life straight. He never did. Then this last time, he put his hand on the Quran and said, "This is finished." In prison, he had heard about Krami, the Malmo program to combat crime and drug use. When he got out, he deleted all his old contacts and went to a meeting. He's now working with the organization to get on the right path. That means a job first, the paying back of debts, a driver's license, and maybe even education somewhere down the road. Now, he is confident that he has the right kind of support. If I cooperate with Krami, I know I will succeed, he says. For the first time in his life, he's not thinking about money for status or for security, but to give back. Sweden, he says, has taught him that lesson. The emotion to Sweden is stronger than before. I am grateful, he says. The last few years I have only taken from the system. Now I want to give to the system. If I give back, God will give to me. You are listening to the Christian Science Monitor Weekly with Roy Weinberg on Sun Sounds of Arizona. All right, now for the global newsstand in the perspective section of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. What this is it identifies a newspaper, where it's from, and it has a title and a paragraph following that. So here we go, from the Sydney Morning Herald, from Sydney, the fossil fuel era is still alive and well. For the last few years, climate and energy policymakers have convinced themselves the world was inexorably moving away from fossil fuels, writes Javier Blas, a London-based columnist for Bloomberg. It is not. Decades more of robust fossil fuel use isn't just possible, but probable. It would be easy to blame the pro-fossil fuel Trump administration for the shift, but that would be a mistake. It precedes its arrival. For now, the world isn't performing an energy transition, but an energy addition, where renewables top up oil, gas, and coal. Regardless of well-intended green aspirations, that will remain the case unless governments impose significant changes. From the Asahi Shimbun from Tokyo, more U.S. missiles won't make Japan safer. The U.S. military has for the first time deployed a medium-range missile launcher in Japan as part of a joint Japan-U.S. training exercise, states an editorial. The move is aimed at countering China, with an eye toward a potential Taiwan contingency. With Beijing and Shanghai falling within range, the deployment of the missile system risks significantly ratcheting up regional tensions. Although the launcher is scheduled to be withdrawn after the exercise, the placement could pave the way for permanent stationing without oversight. The United States has been accelerating development of these weapons to close the gap with China. To be sure, China's rapid military buildup cannot be overlooked as it contributes to regional instability. Even so, simply meeting force with force cannot achieve peace and stability. Now from Al Jazeera in Doha, Qatar, Afghans will be isolated if Taliban completely cuts the internet. Soon you may longer read my stories and those of millions of Afghans because we may not be able to connect to the internet, writes Hujatollah Zia, a Kabul-based journalist and senior writer for Daily Outlook, for Afghanistan newspaper. A nationwide cutoff of internet access imposed by the Taliban would affect Afghan citizens in many ways. Opportunities for online learning and scholarships would be lost. Shutting down the internet would marginalize Afghanistan at the global level. It would be like implementing a self-imposed embargo on the country. Our stories matter, and we want the world to listen to us. Afghans want to remain part of the global community and interact with the rest of the world, not be forced into full isolation. Our next one is from The Hindu from Chennai, India. Trump's new visa policies will hurt the U.S. in the long term or long run. President Donald Trump's decision to charge new applicants for the H-1B highly skilled non-immigrant visa $100,000, nearly six times the current fee, has caused widespread consternation, states an editorial. Indian nationals typically account for 71% of these visas, yet data also suggests that close to 60% of these visa recipients earn less than $100,000, which implies that their employers may find it harder to justify hiring such specialized workers from abroad. While the Trump order is set to expire within a year, there is no guarantee that it would not be extended, making it all the more pertinent for policymakers in India to reduce reliance of Indian tech workers on the shrinking pool of job opportunities in the U.S. It is the U.S. rather than other nations that will suffer. And the last one here is from the Ottawa Citizen from Ottawa, Ontario. Immigration is key, but newcomers must be integrated. Ottawa has changed drastically in the past two decades, writes Eli Mikhail Nasrallah, an author and immigration consultant. Immigrants from every corner of the globe are represented in the immigrants' newcomer population. The question that we must all think about and debate is this: what common values do these diverse newcomers have in common? Canada needs immigration badly, but job one is integration. Job one for newcomers is to make the effort to practice their citizenship and learn to speak to their neighbors in the language of the land they have come to live in. It is a two-way street. And all of this was compiled by Audrey Thibert, who is a staff writer. And now for the explainer in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. We got one article, and it is entitled, "Universities Are Paying the U.S. Millions of Dollars. Where Will the Money Go?" This is written by Ira Porter, who is a staff writer. And they do have that paragraph here, why we wrote this. Columbia and Brown universities have already made deals with the Trump administration to settle claims brought by the government. Harvard and UCLA are in negotiations. Where will the money end up? The Trump administration celebrated a series of multi-million dollar settlements with U.S. universities this summer. The sums were unprecedented, and more might come. In return for the payments and other concessions, schools have had federal funding restored. In total, the settlements amounted to $250 million as of late September, with the potential to reach into the billions. Columbia University agreed to pay a hefty $200 million fine over a three-year period related to anti-Semitism on campus that stemmed from protests over the Israel-Hamas war. The school separately agreed to a $21 million fund to compensate students and faculty at the school with direct payments for anti-Semitism that they experienced. It came after the Trump administration paused $400 million in grants for research, most of which the agreement restored. Columbia also made other concessions, including shifting oversight of student discipline from the faculty senate to administrators. Columbia's reforms are a roadmap for elite universities that wish to regain the confidence of the American public, U.S. Education Secretary Linda McMahon said in a statement. The Columbia agreement is one of many. Brown University agreed to a $50 million deal. The school will pay that money over a 10-year period to state workforce development organizations in Rhode Island to make sure that the initiatives are in compliance with anti-discrimination laws. Brown saw $510 million in funding restored, and all pending anti-discrimination investigations were closed. The University of California, Los Angeles, was fined more than $1 billion by the Trump administration in August related to allegations of anti-Semitism and civil rights violations. Negotiations are ongoing. On September 22nd, U.S. District Judge Rita Lynn granted a preliminary injunction, part of a lawsuit brought by University of California researchers, ordering the government to unfreeze hundreds of millions of dollars in federal grant funding it has withheld from UCLA and other schools in the state system. Harvard, the oldest and wealthiest university in the United States, was reportedly in negotiations with the Trump administration before a judge ruled September 3rd that more than $2 billion in federal funding was taken from the school illegally. The government is appealing that decision and on September 29th also announced that it plans to bar Harvard from receiving future federal funding, which would affect financial aid and research. What follows now is a question and answer piece. Question: so where does the settlement money go? Answer: the short answer, says Mark Harkins, a senior fellow at the Government Affairs Institute at Georgetown University, is that money that has not been earmarked for specific initiatives goes to the U.S. Treasury. It's hard to say where anything will go because nothing is on paper, says Mr. Harkins, but if it truly is a fine, it will go to the U.S. Treasury, the same place that your tax dollars go. In 2024, the Department of Education fined Liberty University $14 million for violating the Clery Act, which requires universities to report campus crime statistics, ensure sexual assault awareness and prevention, publish annual reports with this data, and issue timely warnings for crimes that pose a threat to students and the campus community. That money was paid to the Treasury. Sometimes settlement fines can be paid directly to victims, as Columbia is doing. In 2018, a settlement was upheld by a federal judge in which Trump University paid $25 million to victims who were defrauded by the failed seminar program. A portion of that fine was paid to the New York Attorney General's office to resolve its lawsuit. Once the money is paid to the Treasury, it can be used to cover other deficits, Mr. Harkin says. There's no judge overlooking this. This is basically being tried in the court of public opinion. And so, that gives you all this flexibility and leeway, he says. This is the art of the deal, so to speak. Question: why are schools agreeing to pay? Answer: schools are cutting deals and paying fines because they think it's a smart decision in the long run, says John Fansmith, the Senior Vice President for Government Relations and National Engagement at the American Council on Education, a nonprofit group that advocates policies that affect nearly 1,800 colleges and universities. It's unfortunate, but the federal government has a tremendous ability to inflict harm, he says. He adds that schools fighting the government are in an untenable position because the legal process is incredibly expensive. Schools have to pay legal fees and still risk losing federal funding. Mr. Fansmith says, ultimately, schools wind up coming to terms to simply settle the matter and allow for their students, staff, and researchers to move on and do the work they should be doing. Schools paying up now was a smart play, says Andrew Gillen, a research fellow at the Cato Institute Center for Educational Freedom. Federal funding that was being held up was money that was already approved by the previous administration. But this is all basically fighting over old money. But for the next 3.5 years, the people making decisions on who gets funded are going to be the people you're suing. Even if you win the argument over the old money, you might be putting at risk the new money, he says. Also, fighting the government is expensive. Harvard is an example. The university's recent court victory to restore frozen research funding came after the school had already spent millions of dollars in legal fees to fight the Trump administration, which has argued that Harvard is not eligible for future grants. Harvard has been the only school so far to put up a fight in court. In the process, professors pledged millions of their collective salaries to support the school, and the university freed up $250 million to plug funding gaps. Schools that decided to make payments saw funding restored, unlike Harvard, and in cases where they made concessions, like the University of Pennsylvania, they got funding back. And the final question, why do penalties differ for each institution? And the final answer, the Trump administration has not said why settlement amounts differ. The figures are being created without clarity, Mr. Harkin says, but he suspects there is a reason for the varying amounts that schools are agreeing to pay. There is probably a logic to it that's internal to the Trump administration, he says. When you look at tariffs, they are all over the map, but when somebody went back and said, hey, let's understand why these tariffs are different rates, it turned out that it revolved around what our trade deficit was with that individual country. Using that reasoning, Mr. Harkin suspects that settlements are being made based on the size of the school's endowment. He emphasizes that because none of this is being handled in a court of law, it is at the executive branch discretion to promise not to investigate schools if they settle. Mr. Gillen of the Cato Institute thinks it's something different. From what I've seen, he says, it's almost like the amounts are being determined by how vulnerable the school is to the withholding of future federal funding, that it is any actual problem that they're being punished for. And now for the Home Forum in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. There's one article, and I will read it. It's entitled, Hanging Up on an Old Friend. After 40 years, I cut the cord on my landline and bade goodbye to an era of close connections. This is written by Margaret Rogers. This morning, I disconnected my landline. For nearly 40 years, I had the same number, 549-6970. I loved how it rolled off the tongue. So easy to remember, almost lyrical. It made me sad to think of it being reassigned to someone else, someone who wouldn't appreciate it as I did. I should have cut the cord years ago. It's been little more than a magnet for junk calls, much like the junk mail filling up my post office box. I used to keep it as a backup in case the internet went out, but now even landlines run on broadband. Even so, I wasn't ready to let go of my old friend tethered to the wall. That string of numbers, 549 and 6970, was a part of my history. It was the phone on which I spent hours talking to friends and family. Back in the old days, I'd return home from a trip and race to check the answering machine. Often, it was my mother. "Nothing urgent," she'd say in her Polish-accented voice, tinged with melancholy, "but call when you get a chance." After she lost her ability to speak, I missed those guilt-laden messages. I also liked that the landline was never associated with any one person. It was simply part of the house, like a stereo system, another part of my life that I've replaced with new technology. Which is why, when the phone rang in my house when I was growing up, if you weren't the first to answer it, everyone knew your business. "Are you friends with Amy again?" my sister would ask. If the phone rang and I happened to pick it up, I might end up talking to my mother's best friend for just a few minutes. She always wanted to know how I was doing. That kind of connection never happens now when we only talk to the people who we meant to call or who meant to call us. It makes us a little more isolated from each other. These days, I rarely call anyone. If I do call, I've usually text them first to check if it's a good time to talk. I don't even like talking on the phone anymore, except with an old friend from high school with whom I used to gab for hours every day after school. I don't even like talking to my husband when we've been apart for a few days. I feel awkward, and I often want to get off. When my cell rings, I often feel hijacked by the unexpected interruption. And even though I know I can just decline the call, it still feels intrusive. How dare you demand my attention the minute you want to talk to me when I might be at the movies or shopping? One of the great things about a landline was that it was meant to stay in one place. Unlike my smartphone, which I must carry everywhere like a ball and chain lest I fail to hear the ring. I could never miss a call coming in on 549-6970. Its shrill, unmistakable jangle could penetrate through any distraction. And that's precisely what prompted me to call the phone company today, another piercing early morning call from a telemarketer. There I was, dripping wet from the shower, dashing to answer, only to hear the familiar sales pitch from my best friend, Cardholder Services. Enough was enough. I called and disconnected my service. But after I hung up, I felt sad. I realized the landline was more than just a phone to me. It was a symbol of a time when we talked to each other rather than texted, when spontaneous calls turned into hours-long heart-to-hearts. There was something so wonderfully unplanned about those conversations. Someone called, you answered, and the next thing you knew, you were lying on the floor with a cord wrapped around your fingers, laughing or crying or listening to someone on the other end. No calendar invite, no can you talk now preamble. You didn't need a reason to call. You just did. And that kind of closeness is hard to come by now. Disconnecting 549-6970 felt like closing a chapter. Its dial tone is now just a memory, but a part of me will always be waiting for its loud ring. And now we find ourselves at the Monitor's View in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. These are articles written by the editorial staff, and there are two of them, and I believe I have time to read both. The first one is entitled, Germany Seeks a Balance on Immigration. A decade ago, Germany opened its borders to more than 1 million migrants, mainly Syrians, as well as Afghans and Iraqis. Many were fleeing brutal civil wars. At the time, Chancellor Angela Merkel declared, "We can manage this," and the challenging task of integrating refugees began. But the welcome mat soon wore thin. And that was even before the unexpected flow of another 1.25 million refugees from Ukraine after Russia's 2022 invasion. Now, like much of Europe, Germany is tightening border controls, turning away many migrants, encouraging others to return home, and deporting those in the country illegally or with criminal records. German politics has been upended by the rise of anti-immigrant sentiment. We clearly did not cope with the issue, current Chancellor Friedrich Merz has said, but he has also acknowledged an inescapable fact. Germany is a country of immigration, he said in May. Migrants made up 20.9% of the population last year, compared with 13.4% in 2015. Ordinary Germans recognize this new reality. Citing costs and cultural differences, 68% of citizens want fewer refugees. But 63% agree that immigration is important for the economy. In 2024, there were more than 5,750 Syrian doctors working in the country. And Germany faces labor shortages across 163 occupations. The challenge for Europe's largest economy is how to stem illegal migration and better integrate legal immigrants, while staying true to its democratic principles. This might require a shift in perspective and a focus on available data and facts. As labor researcher Herbert Brucker told Bloomberg recently, the glass is more half full than half empty when it comes to refugees' role in the economy. For refugees who arrived between 2013 and 2019, there were 68% employed 8 years after arrival. As more find work, they reduce the strain on the welfare state. They also contribute as employers and community leaders. For example, Dyer Kahl arrived in 2014 as a teenager. He now speaks German fluently and employs 15 people at his tech firm in Mannheim. Ryan Elshebel, who fled Syria as a 21-year-old, was elected mayor of Astolsheim in 2023. It's a liberal country, he told Reuters. Whoever is ready to do something here can get the opportunity to do so. Shortly before leaving office in April, Germany's former interior minister stressed the importance of debating migration without resentment and with awareness that we are talking about human beings. Calling for more respect for the millions of residents from immigrant backgrounds, she reminded Germany, "We are one country, we are one society, and we belong together." Our next Monitor's View article is entitled, "Country Music Crosses Oceans. From Bach to Beyoncé, music remains a universal language. Puccini plays well in Shanghai's Opera House. Tokyo has dozens of jazz clubs. Paul Simon tapped into South African rhythms. Now, twang and all, American country music has hit a high note in the land of the Queen's English. For the first time in its century of broadcasting, the Grand Ole Opry show relocated from Nashville, Tennessee to London's famed Royal Albert Hall for a one-night performance in September. The official reason for this temporary musical transplant is that the world's longest-running live radio show, first called WSM Barn Dance, is celebrating its 100th anniversary this year. Another is a cowboy hat tip to one of the genre's origins, Scottish and Irish settlers in America, who blended their fiddles and folk singing with the banjos and lyrical narration of black people. Yet another reason is a recent burst of interest in country music in the United Kingdom, Germany, and Australia. In Britain, it is now the fastest growing genre. I just think country music is a place that everybody can go and enjoy, Grammy-nominated singer Luke Combs told BBC News. Or, as writer Kristen Amiet lays out in The Australian, the universal appeal of this music from America helps explain how a nation that can't agree on health care or gun control or immigration or law enforcement or education can come together at a Dolly Parton concert and get along. About 15% of visitors to the Grand Ole Opry stage in Nashville are from outside the U.S. This iconic institution, as iconic as the Royal Albert Hall, has helped musicians blend new sounds, such as rap. yet the music still keeps its distinctive bass notes of community and comfort. The genre is so expansive in terms of the spectrum of music and fan base that it can address today, and I think that's why it's a movement, not a moment, Patrick Moore, CEO of Opry Entertainment Group, told the National Business Journal. The Opry's first overseas broadcast reflects a confidence that it, as well as country music, will exist for another 100 years. This unique universal language is eternal. Its harmony builds bridges, even across oceans. Well, we still have a little bit of time left, so I'll go to the Numbers in the News column in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly and read some of the statistics. 3,384. That's the number of civilian fatalities from Sudan's civil war during the first 6 months of 2025, as reported by the United Nations. That represents an 80% increase over documented civilian casualties during all of 2024. 200 million, that's the amount of workers in China's gig economy, people who rely on flexible jobs, often as factory workers, in delivery services, or as online freelancers. This group makes up a quarter of the nation's total workforce. 30, that's the minimum percentage increase in ocean acidity since the Industrial Revolution. The Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research says the 30 to 40% increase in acidification puts many marine organisms at risk, especially corals and shelled creatures. 20, that's the amount of dollars, the price of a frozen supermarket chicken in the capital of Malawi, where most people live on less than $2 a day. Malawians returned to former president to office last month amid an economic crisis marked by a 30% inflation rate. Well, by looking at the old clock on the wall, I can see that we are at the conclusion of this week's Christian Science Monitor weekly program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Roy Weinberg. Thank you for joining me this week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.